Hey everybody, welcome to the call. Thanks for coming. This is Ramit Sethi here from I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and I'm thrilled to have one of my good friends and also author extraordinaire Tim Ferriss. Today's talk is on the psychology of testing. Tim, welcome to the call. Thanks a lot for doing it.
Thanks for having me.
So you and I, well, first of all, congratulations on the book. Last I checked yesterday, it was still number one on Amazon.
Thank you very much. It's been an unusual journey, as always it is with books.
What I want to do is talk today about the psychology of testing. But actually, I just first wanted to share a little story. I don't know if everyone knows this. When you were writing your book, you and I, we went out to dinner, and I actually didn't know what you were doing with the book at that point. And we, I don't know if you remember, but we ordered this gigantic steak dinner. After we were done, we had dessert and everything, and then you said, hey, do you guys mind if I order something else? I'm doing some testing. And I was like, all right, I thought you were going to order another dessert or whatever. And then you go ahead and order an entire another steak and pulled up your shirt to reveal some kind of weird monitor you had on your stomach. And I was like, all right, this is serious.
So oh, I remember that.
Yeah, 8,000 calorie dinner or whatever that was. So, okay, yep. So this is great. I am thrilled to talk to you today about testing. But first, I kind of just wanted to talk about the four-hour body and any surprises that you came across. I mean, personally, when I wrote about it on my site and in my emails, a lot of people were, you know, they were like predictably skeptical and even angry. And I can only imagine that I just scratched the surface. I'm curious about the reactions from people, both, you know, people who have gotten good results and also skeptics, just out of curiosity.
The response has been, as you would expect, very polarizing. The feedback has been overwhelmingly positive, and it's been most entertaining to watch and enjoyable to watch on Twitter and through blogs and wikis and so forth, since one of the underlying tenets of the book is self-tracking. So you see people literally, I would say, on some days, hundreds of feedback postings and status updates on Twitter with measurements. That's really fun to watch. So there are people who've lost 20, 30 pounds since the book came out, which is about a month ago, if not more in some cases. There are people who have fixed fertility problems. There are people who have certainly experimented with the sexual chapters, like the 15-minute female orgasm, for which the book last week was apparently yanked from Costco.
Wow.
Which I thought was amusing. And on the negative side, or the negative response side, the most controversial chapter is definitely Geek to Freak, the muscle gain chapter, for whatever reason. And there are some very smart weight trainers out there. There are also a lot of meatheads, and the meatheads took very personal offense that I would even claim that such a change is possible despite the documentation. So that was very controversial. I did talk very openly about anabolics, meaning anabolic steroids, different type of growth factors that could be used post-surgery, etc. And that did not seem to spark much controversy at all. Which was surprising to me, and it doesn't make a difference because I wrote it to be valuable, not just to be controversial, but it really did not produce the type of the outburst that I expected through, let's say, morning TV shows. And it didn't even come up. Never once did it come up that I can recall in any interview, which was surprising to me. For those people curious, I forgot that you were at that meal where I had the two steaks was the night before the opening scene in the Sex Machine Adventures in Tripling Testosterone chapter, I believe. Yeah, I know that dinner makes a guest appearance in the book.
That's funny. So, and what about you? Like, knowing and having gone through all this, one of the things I've learned as I've, you know, written books and met other authors is that at a certain point, sometimes authors may have followed their own philosophies and you know, patterns or whatever, but as they get more experience, they kind of discard some of that and grow with some of it. Since you've written the book, are you continuing to follow the basics of it, or have you changed anything since the publication?
I have more, I've kept the same approach. Certainly the testing approach, because it's just based on the scientific method, has not changed. And I think that's true whether you're split testing a website or split testing a diet. In the case of the exact protocols, there were a few areas that were a bit confusing to more than a handful of people. For example, where I would suggest that you eliminate dairy, but if the only protein you can consume in the morning is whole fat cottage cheese, then that is allowable but not ideal. And some people shouted from the rooftops about how Tim Ferriss was contradicting himself and didn't make any sense. Whereas in reality, I didn't want to get into the details which relate to insulinemic index and whey and so forth and so on. So there are a few points like that that I wanted to clarify, but the how-to didn't change. The why-to and the explanation of the mechanism changed a bit. But my approach really hasn't varied much. I would say that the same investigative assumption testing approach there, and all of that starts with tracking data.
Okay, great. So let's talk about data and testing. This is one thing that I have been hammering my readers with, which is the idea that, you know, you may be really smart, you may not be smart, you may be experienced or inexperienced, but ultimately if you can get a testing mentality and testing mindset and then start doing some tests, you will often rock your own world with the results you can get. And you did a great job with the 4-Hour Body. You and I have spent a lot of time talking about different tests we've run, whether it be split tests or any other kind of test. So I wanted to start by just asking you, what is testing? How do you think about testing? And give us a couple examples of some things you do test.
I think about testing as, honestly, fun experiments. I actually get very excited when I prove myself wrong, which may be a perverse mutation, it could be. But I test everything from blog headlines, and I can do that a number of different ways. I use supersu.pr, and I can schedule to release blog posts through those broadcasting means at two different times, let's say, and I could hit Facebook on one and hit Twitter on another. I could also use two different time zones, so I'll test the response, meaning click-through rate, to the same headline across different time zones. I will certainly test advertisements. So we tested, I would say, close to a dozen different advertisements that readers designed for the book. We tested at the top right of the blog, underneath blog posts. Video, we've tested video response. And then from the personal standpoint, of course, I've tested all the physical stuff, which would include thousands of blood tests, different types of exercise protocols, different types of drug protocols, goes on and on and on. So I would say that the process of discovery is exciting to me, and people would embrace testing more if they looked at it that way. And I think part of the reason, and I know that we were going to touch upon this, but I'll bring it up now. Part of the reason people are phobic about testing is they think of it as mathematically complex. And you and I both know that it's not mathematically complex at all. You really just have to know a few different numbers. And you're talking to someone who went to Princeton University partially because it didn't have a math requirement. So
another
that was one of my motivations for going.
Avoiding math.
I mean, avoiding math to the extent that it determined my choice of school. So I understand how people feel when they're phobic about math, but you really don't need much. And especially now with the tools that are available, it's very, very easy to do.
So I love what you said about you like to disprove yourself, because at a certain point it becomes a game. It's not like, let me try to test this for some sophisticated mathematical, statistical regression thing. It's just like, hey, let me see if this is right or wrong. So if you're just a normal person, what are like two or three things that you could start testing today?
And that's for business purposes?
Let's say business
or other purposes.
Yeah, any purpose. I mean, for me, you know, I spoke recently about testing responses when someone asked me, what do you do or where do you live? And I tested it, and it was like a huge difference in the response rate. Within 10 tests, I could find a huge difference. So let's say from a business perspective, what would you touch on? And then let's talk about conversational testing as well.
Yeah, all right. So if I'm thinking about as broadly as possible from a business standpoint, I would do an 80-20 analysis of your customer base just to understand your baseline first. This is another mistake that people make, is they don't understand where they are first, and then they jump out and start doing testing. So what I would say is do an 80-20 analysis of your customer base, identify the 20% or so of customers who are producing 80 or more of a profit, 80% or more of a profit, and then test different cross-selling and upselling packages on those most profitable, lowest maintenance customers, meaning can you get those customers, since they're already your most profitable, to buy larger larger packages at a time? Can you get them to buy more frequently by putting them into a continuity program of some type? And this would all be verbal, just like your or an email, but you don't have to actually necessarily think through how you're going to deliver all of these things to begin with. You certainly can't process a credit card before you do that, but you could shoot out an email or talk to them on the phone and see what they would be most open to. And I think that's a very clear example of testing using a telephone or email. You're not even, and you're just going to be hitting, let's say, 10 or 20 customers, but you should be able to get a pretty clear indication, especially via phone, of which options they're most open to. And just by doing that alone, that type of testing, in 2004, I was able to take my management of my customers, my customer service, from 60 plus hours to less than 2 hours a week, by focusing on those most profitable customers. And I was also able to increase my profit by about 30%. And that was just by focusing on those types of customers, asking those types of questions.
So people can also take this 80-20 analysis, which you wrote about in the 4-Hour Workweek, and they can also apply it to their own work. So on a day-to-day basis, where are they spending their time and where are they getting their results? And when, yep. You know, the first common reaction people get when you tell them about an 80-20 analysis, they'll say things like, well, that only works if you run your own company, or I can't do that because I don't live in San Francisco, or all kinds of crazy excuses. And the truth is, like, you don't have to change anything. Just an analysis in and of itself, that won't change anything. It's just going to give you some insight. And when people do that, I mean, I've done it, and I try to do it every so often, and I'm always astonished. I'm like, really? I'm spending, you know, 40% of my time doing that, and it has literally no outcome whatsoever. And I can immediately cut that off or delegate it. And you open up sometimes 2 hours a day just by doing that analysis. Have you had that experience too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just 2 days ago realized how much email had overtaken my time. And this is after having a Batcave secret email, but you and I both know what happens is you send your secret email to someone and then they're like, hey, meet Joe. And then Joe's like, hey, let me put you on a group email for my dinner that you can't come to. And then before you know it, you have 1,000 people emailing you. And so something that I just split tested, and you actually tweeted about this, was my new autoresponder. I don't know if you want to tell people my new autoresponder is.
I literally started cracking up yesterday alone in my apartment because it said, I sent Tim an email, and then the response came back in an autoresponder instantly, and it said, thank you for your email. Sadly, it will be deleted.
So
that is very classy, very nice.
Yeah, I've tested a lot of autoresponders. So far, that's definitely the most effective at stopping email. And to be fair, just so people understand what the follow-up is to that, that's not the entire autoresponder. That'd be a dickish maneuver. At the bottom it says I'm taking 4 weeks off of email. Please email me again in March if it's still relevant. But yeah, I think it can be as simple as that. It can be as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. And for a lot of people who work at 9-to-5 jobs, one thing that can be done is just to start by doing an 80-20 analysis. In other words, where are you spending your time and where are you getting your results? And when you find something, and often when you do it for the first time, it's almost like starting to work out for the first time. You can get a lot of benefits when you first start working out or stopping smoking for the first time. When you do this first analysis, you can often find huge things that you're wasting time on. And then it becomes a question of how do I deal with it? So you can disentangle those two things. First, understand what you're spending time on. That's the analysis part. And then it can be delegating it or convincing your boss to let someone else take it over or simply not doing it and getting better results with the more meaningful thing. But a lot of times people entangle those two things, and that's why they don't start testing. They're like, they start worrying about the results when they just need to worry about the analysis up front.
Yep, so, agreed.
What about like, you know, one of the things I hear from a lot of people, and we're going to open it up for a question in a few minutes, is like the thing about the idea about fear. So a lot of people talk about fear. They actually don't use this word very often, but they'll say code words for fear, like, I'm nervous about doing this. I don't think I have the ability to test, etc. Have you encountered this with people? Have you ever been nervous about a test you've run? And if so, what have you done about that?
I've been nervous about tests I've run when I've bet too much. And I think it's important, and still to this very day, I test extremely small. So if I test, let's say, the subtitle of my new book, which I did, I put together somewhere between 5 and 10 subtitles that I could live with, first of all. And then I shot it out with a SurveyMonkey survey, just surveymonkey.com, very easy, to 50 to 100 of my friends and acquaintances who are good marketers. So I started off with 50 to 100 friends. Once I had feedback, then I tested it on Facebook, on my Facebook fan page in the middle of the night, like 2 in the morning, to get a few hundred people, perhaps. And then once I had that data and felt a little more comfortable with it, I blasted it out to Twitter and Facebook and lived the day. But starting off small, one test that I was very nervous about running was something that seemed too good to be true and ended up being too good to be true, and that was when I negotiated with a radio syndicate for advertising. And there was I think it was like $500,000 to $750,000 ad campaign that had been canceled by a big pharma company. And I negotiated, and I bought it for $10,000. Now, $10,000 to me at the time was extremely—it's a huge, huge, huge sum of money. And but I was tricked by the retail price and what I negotiated it for. So I assumed, of course, it's going to be worth more than $10,000 because they were selling it for almost $1 million or $500,000. And the ads were supposed to be run during drive time. And they said, oh, yeah, it'll be when people are driving their cars. And then nothing happened. There were no orders coming in. None. Like, no phone calls. And I found out that drive time was technically, this is why it's important to know the details, between, I think it was 5:30 in the morning and 8:30 in the morning, and so they written them all at like 5:35 a.m. And that was lesson learned. Once again, though, start small, and small doesn't mean 90% off. Small means an absolute number. It's not intimidating to you, and $10,000 was way too intimidating and way too serious for me to bite off in one chunk.
Yeah, that's great advice. Start small. Okay, excellent. Okay, guys, anyone listening right now, if you're listening live, there's a place on the right side of your screen to ask a question. So go ahead and ask those questions, and we'll try to answer them in the next, do it in about 15 minutes. All right, Tim, one thing that I want to shift to now is talking about disproportionate results. When I think of the person who most embodies getting disproportionate results, that's mm-hmm. you. So that is putting in a certain amount of effort, but getting 2x, 3x, 100x what other people would do. And when I was brainstorming today, I was thinking about you writing a book, the 80-20 analysis that you did of your customer service, health. So when I go to the gym now and I'm using some of your material, which I do, by the way, I don't have to work on stuff that's not going to produce results. I can work on stuff that's going to get me disproportionate results. Can you talk about... how do you think about disproportionate results? And give us a couple examples of how you've implemented this into your life.
So to determine where your leverage points are, there are a few things. I would say that it's helpful, and I never recommend this, almost never recommend this, but it makes sense when you're trying to get disproportionate results. I think you should always be trying to do. But I don't usually use this MBA term, which makes me crazy. But there's something called a SWOT analysis, and it stands for strength.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Okay. So so SWOT, you can help me. I don't even remember what the T stands for. But strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. That's what it is. And to give you an example, when I began planning the 4-Hour Body before we even had a title for it. It was strengths. I knew I had the blog. Strengths, I knew I could get feedback from the blog and identify which content was most likely to be popular from the very outset just by looking at blog comments or by asking, what would you prefer? Would you prefer this or this? What should I put in the book? Which experts should I contact? That type of thing. And I had people fill out Google forms to provide that information. Weaknesses, I've never been in that category. I didn't know the book buyers, let's say at Barnes & Noble, for example. I didn't know the category buyers for health and fitness. Opportunities, nothing like this had been pushed through the tech channels before. So if you look at my eventual launch, certainly you'll notice that I targeted very heavily a handful of outlets that were entirely tech-focused, like Gizmodo, TechCrunch, Mashable, etc. And then threats would be looking at, for me, the timing. Timing is really important. So I knew precisely which books I would be competing against. Okay? So I knew that Guinness Book Awards would be a significant threat. The perennial number one in the New York Times. I knew that Ian Martin and the Barefoot Contessa would be a threat. And I looked at all the book scan numbers to find out what their sales numbers looked like. And Guinness, I had multiple years to look at so I could identify how many copies it appeared I needed to sell minimum to have a chance at number one. And that was 50,000 copies in the first week. And that then gives me what I would call, and this is very similar to the 4-hour body rather, is the minimum effective dose. What is the number? What is your goal? And I think that when many people test, they don't have a goal that's acceptable. So they'll do, let's say, click-through analysis, and they'll say, okay, well, we have these three ads. This one's better than the second one, but you kind of don't like the third one. You know, third one is the ugly one that you hoped wouldn't work, and then it worked. Which happens a lot with testing
all the time.
You get an ad and you're like, what? That's the one that won? Oh my God, I hate that ad. It makes my blog look like, you know, it has a Catch the Monkey, win an iPod advertisement on it. And if you've defined what your target monthly income is and the click-through rate for the second advertisement that you actually like is sufficient, then you stick with that ad. And in my case, for the campaign, I knew that my target was 50,000 books in the first week minimum, and I could plan around that, and it made everything else easier to put into place. So that would be an example.
When you say you plan around that, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that you were not, for example, going after, you know, places that were going to sell 50 books? Is that what you mean?
That's one thing that I would, yes, absolutely. So I decided that I would try to focus on outlets that I felt could produce book sales of 1,000 books or more. And that became one of my criteria, which I broke a few times. But in general, I wanted to try to focus on initiatives and campaigns that could move 1,000 books. And what that would mean then, and recognizing that I had limited time, is that I also would, rather than getting a very, very short mention from 100 blogs, I would focus on 10 or 15 and really try to do in-depth pieces with those people. What that also meant was I wanted to gauge how much work I needed to do early on. And if you'll recall, one of my weaknesses was that I didn't know the buyers of Barnes & Noble. And I wanted Barnes & Noble to love me. So I did an exclusive signed edition of the book that could only be bought through BN.com. And ended up selling close to 8,000 copies. And this was well before the book came out, probably a month to a month and a half, if I'm guessing correctly, before the book came out, which gave the buyer the chance to get very enthusiastic. And, I mean, everybody freaked out because that broke just about every record they'd ever had, and get very excited about the book and then re-up orders for retail placement. So if you look at the SWOT analysis I just gave, a lot of my planning falls right in line with having that data in front of me.
Interesting. Now, when we think about disproportionate results and we think about, let's say, the average person, I would say that my inclination or my intuition would say most people don't target disproportionate results. They, you know, might do the same thing as someone in their very same industry or at their same job, and the thing is, we all want disproportionate outcomes and disproportionate results, but sometimes we don't do the disproportionate work in order to do it. So just listening to your story, I mean, just the fact that you knew who you were going up against, you did all the research, you knew the book scan numbers, that is an extraordinary level of work. But, I mean, think about 2 years from now, you're going to look back, you don't even remember how much work you put into that, but you're still going to have all the results of that hard work you put in, right?
Yep, absolutely. And I would also say that people tend to default, and this was true for me for a long time as well, to working harder to fix overwhelm. It's generally hard to fix overwhelm by working harder. It doesn't work very well. So what I try to do is before game time or at the earliest point possible is to do the hard thinking up front so I prevent that overwhelm from happening in the first place. And if you're in a state of overwhelm right now, you can still sit down and do the hard thinking so you know where you are, find some numbers that illustrate where you are, how many hours a day you spend on email, for example, and then determine what needs to change in terms of process for you to fix the problem in a sustainable fashion. So, for example, as you know, or me, I mean, 2 days ago I had 700 unread email, and I spent 3 hours going through picking out some of the most important, and then I just archived everything and set up my autoresponder. And that will produce some small problems. It will produce some temporary problems, but it's more than worth that to reach inbox zero and be able to start from scratch and focus on other things. So I think really taking the time to do the hard thinking in the beginning will save you the stress of continually working harder and never seeming to make any progress later.
Yeah, you've always been about not just devoting willpower to something, but actually setting up processes and systems to make it better.
Right.
That seems to work really well for you.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I would throw out there is there's a great book. It's very short, and it's called The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. It's probably 120, 130 pages, and it is an outstanding book that I would recommend everyone read. There's a chapter called Know Thy Time, which is about doing a time audit, just like we've been discussing. Peter Drucker, for those who don't know, is probably the most famous management theorist of the last 100 years. Just an incredible guy. And I thought it was going to be a bunch of BS, quite frankly, before I actually read any Drucker. I thought it was going to be really high, pie in the sky type of work with integrity. Be honest. You have to focus on your core values. And don't get me wrong, all that stuff's important, but to someone who's treading water and overwhelmed, none of that helps. They need really specific tactics. And one of the points the effective executive makes is that the best executives make very few decisions. Whenever they run into a problem or something that consumes a lot of time, they ask themselves, is there any chance that this will happen again? And if so, they create a rule for it so they don't have to think about it in the future. They just decide what their default action will be in the future or how they can prevent it in the future.
Nice. Very interesting. Drucker also said, similarly, that just like we look at our spending and we might try to keep a budget or at least analyze where our spending is going, do the same with your time. Look at your calendar for the last, even one, talk about small tests. You don't have to do the last 10 months of your calendar. Look at the last 1 week and just say, you know, where am I spending my time? Where do I want to be spending my time? And then figure out the difference. How do you get to where you want to be? Without sitting down, without getting that baseline, as you said, it's going to be impossible for you to get where you want to go.
Yep, and he's also very famously quoted as saying, what gets measured gets managed. That is a Peter Drucker quote.
Yep. Exactly. Okay, so let's move to our final thing. Before we talk about our final topic and then take questions, I'll just ask anyone listening live, if you want to ask a question, go ahead, use the panel on your right, and we're going to try to answer as many as possible. Okay, so Tim, the last thing I want to talk about, which you have demonstrated very well in the last few months, is the power of your network. So mm-hmm. I remember Charlie, who worked for both of us and works for you now, he talked about how you couldn't have done what you did without all your friends, that essentially you didn't even ask people to promote you. They just wanted to promote you, and they wanted to help out, get your book going big. And I wanted to talk about the power of a network. Not everyone has a book, but everyone has a network. And everyone can use that network and help that network and nurture it. I wonder if you can talk about how you think about your network.
There are a few things that I would say. So the first is, I'll tell you what I don't do. What I don't do is go to an event, figure out who's going to be most useful to me, and then do whatever necessary to try to become buddy-buddy with those people, which is how most people think of networking. I will go to an event, try to identify the, let's say, general group of person who could be very helpful, whether that's a programmer of some specific type or someone who knows about a specific topic. And then I'll go to the organizer of the event and I'll say, of the people in that group, who do you think I'd really get along with? These are the things I'm interested in. I'm kind of weird. I do this. I do rock climbing. I like physical testing. I wear implants. That sounds bad. I don't wear implants. I put implants in my side to test glucose. You know, who do you think I'd actually hit it off with? And I would then meet someone who had a very cool skill set. But at the same time, I would meet someone that I could be friends with even if they did not have that skill set. And I think it's a very important distinction, because if you look at, let's say, the people I became friends with initially when I was building the groundwork for 4-Hour Work Week, I'm still friends with those people. you know, it's like, and I've been friends with them for 3-4 years, and it's not like I've only stayed friends with them because they've had some utility. For that entire time. It's because we actually get along and share things in common outside of whatever our business interests might be. But what I would say a few things. So that's the basic. The second point I would make is that you should friends help their friends, but let me tell you what that doesn't mean. And this is another common mistake, I think. If you do someone a favor, You can hope that they'll help you in the future with something, but you should not expect it. Do not do a favor simply as a way to line up something you're going to ask them to do in the future. That makes me fucking insane. And it's so clear when people do it also. And they're like, hey, buddy, remember when I did that? It's so crass. I really dislike that approach. And I don't do it. I really try not to do it to other people ever. And I really dislike when people do it to me. So help people, but don't expect them to come back and then help you because of that favor. I think that's with your best friends, at least speaking for myself, you don't keep track of that kind of stuff. And if you're legitimately friends with these people, you shouldn't do that either. The last point I would make is that I think many people spend 20% of their time building their product and 80% of their time thinking about the magical marketing solution, and they should switch that entirely and spend 80% of the time making the best product humanly possible and 20% of the time on the marketing, and it's a hell of a lot more effective. So if I had gone to, if I'd gone to you, or if I'd gone to Brian at Gizmodo and given them a really crappy book and been like, hey guys, we'd really love your help by doing a big blog post on this, it would have been horrible. It would have been made everyone uncomfortable, and it would have probably led to a great many people saying, no, we can't do this, or for some reason making up an excuse why they couldn't do it. So you have to also provide something that they'll actually, your fan base, which includes your network, will actually enjoy and benefit from and want to share. And I cannot overstate that enough. I think that the biggest mistakes I see in networking are those three. Also, thinking that networking will fix a bad product, and it won't, because you can effectively buy the first round of customers with marketing, but in a digital world, then you're dead. You're toast. You can't. You won't. The word of mouth is not going to spread through marketing alone. You need a good product.
So, rewind us back to Tim pre-4-Hour Work Week, and you were sending emails and meeting bloggers and meeting all these people just to, you know, for coffee. That's how we met. What did your email say? What exactly did you write? Because I want other people to know how they can go. You know, a lot of people, they're stuck as to what even to say in an email. Why would anyone want to meet with them? So, what did you say?
When I wanted to meet with someone. I'll tell you what I did, because there are a few things. The first is that I recognized after trying it for a while that it was futile to do it on my own. And let me explain how I fixed that. So for me to send an email, well, there are a few things. I could approach people who were, let's say, Princeton grads, but for the most part, investment banking, management consulting, not of great interest to me. Second was I found it much more fun and effective to, in my case, I moved out to California, first job out of college. I'm working in a tech startup, and I wanted to expand my network. I ended up volunteering for a group called the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs, which is SVASE, SVASE.org. I'm pretty sure it's still around. And I began volunteering and just doing a kick-ass job volunteering at these events, which generally included a panel of 5 to 6 business titans of some type. And the moderator was usually the chairwoman of the organization, and dinners, and they were pretty fancy events. I mean, people would spend $100-$200 to come to these events. And I volunteered for a few events, and I always took on more responsibility than I had to. So I ended up basically managing the other volunteers because I was the one who would step up and volunteer to do it. And if you're not getting paid, it's more work. And I made a point of, by doing that, getting to know Laura Roden, who is the chairwoman of all of SVASE. And I asked her after maybe the third event if I could possibly sit in on a board meeting to hear what their plans are and see how I could help further. She allowed me to come to this meeting, and I then went to 2 or 3 of those meetings trying to offer suggestions where I felt they'd be helpful, but not overplaying my hand and being too aggressive. Then I approached Laura and asked her if I could actually manage an entire main event. So if I could be the one who effectively produced the event, and here's the point to pay attention to recruit the 5 to 6 business titans to come speak on the panel. So that's how I got [S2] Nice. [S1] To know Jack. That's how I got to know Jack Canfield. That's how I got to know Ed Bird, who commercialized creatine. Ed Bird, people will recognize, makes a cameo in the 4-Hour Work Week. Jack Canfield, many years later, I guess probably, let's think about this, 5 years later, introduced me to the gentleman, Steve Hanselman, who ended up becoming my agent for the 4-Hour Work Week, and so forth and so on. So I built my network in large part through volunteering at nonprofits that already had access to those people or whose name would be credible when I contacted those people. And I think that's a very, very practical approach.
I love that. For everyone listening, let's try to extract the points. It's not about picking a nonprofit to work for. That's not the point. The point is going and trying, testing different approaches, always offering value. Notice that it wasn't some grand strategic master plan. It was just a series of systematic steps of offering value, helping people out, and then one day seizing an opportunity that most people wouldn't want to do because it's more work. But when you put yourself in the middle of a cool transaction or a cool success, good things are going to come your way.
Yep, I agree.
Let's shift to questions. Shift to questions right away. We've got a ton of them here. All right, so we'll start with a couple different ones. This one's from Paul. He says, how do you sift through the large amount of information when you have access to when you research a topic? Do you have any sort of note-taking system?
Ooh, that's a good question. I wish I could ask him a follow-up question to clarify, but I do have a note-taking system. For what it's worth, I do have a particular way of taking notes when I read books in particular. If you look up how to take notes like an alpha geek on my blog, I actually did an entire blog post on how I take notes in books, and it has to do with creating an index and notes typically on the bottom right-hand page or right-hand corner of pages, rather. When I'm sifting through a lot of information, I also try to identify people who've already sifted through that information. And if you're simply contacting someone for a clarification, they tend to be very, very helpful. So you could, let's say, in my case, when I was looking at running for the 4-Hour Body, I had already read a book called Born to Run, and Scott Jurek made an appearance in that book, and his name had come up a number of times. So I reached out and contacted Scott, and it was very, very easy to do. And I think that before you do these types of things and reach out to experts, it's helpful to read, and I usually don't plug this hard, but there is one sidebar in the 4-Hour Work Week called the Expert Builder, and it's about establishing credibility, whether that's by volunteering for SVASE or speaking at a well-known university as a lecturer or speaking at well-known companies, having just a few lines of borrowed credibility or writing a piece for a well-known newspaper or let's say the blog of a well-known newspaper, which is not that hard to do, anything like that that'll allow you to say something along the lines of, I work with this organization or have worked with this newspaper and therefore I'm credible, will help you get further when you're contacting people who have already sifted through the information, which ultimately I think is the fastest way to do so.
Love it. Love it. I'll add one thing, which is whenever I go to write a post, typically I've been keeping notes on it for 2 to 5 years. I have notes in my Delicious tags. I have notes in different email tags. And sometimes I just have text files. It's not organized as well as you would love, et cetera. But I know that when I start brainstorming a topic, I don't have to go and look for material. I've already been saving and pulling up the most important pieces for years. That really saves a lot of heartache.
You actually brought up a really good point. I use Evernote. If we're talking about online data gathering, I use Evernote as my default center for gathering everything. So,
What's the name of that software you used for your book? I thought it was really fascinating.
Scrivener? Is that the one you were thinking of?
Yeah, yeah.
I used Evernote to gather data online, and then I used Scrivener for writing. And the reason Scrivener is very, very fascinating to me, it's typically used for screenplays, and that's just S-C-R-I-V-E-N-E-R, is that you can create a table of contents, and it's folders or documents, on the left-hand pane, and then on the right-hand pane, you can split the screen. You can have your text document that you're working on, let's say your chapter that you're working on, and again, it's split screen, and below that, you have research. And it's such a simple, seemingly simple feature that I could not find anywhere else. So to have your research and what you're writing on the screen at the same time in a way that is easy to use was extremely, extremely helpful. So I used Evernote, then Scrivener, and then the publisher had to use Word, so we moved to Word very reluctantly. But if you're doing it on your own, I would say that Evernote and Scrivener are very helpful in combination.
All right, let's take this question from Holly. What is your strategy for dealing with naysayers? While it's easy to ignore these people, it's not constructive to ignore everyone. So how do you deal with these naysayers?
I try to be polite. The only time that I really try to respond to naysayers is if there's something factually incorrect in their criticism. And even then, I don't do it very often. I almost never respond to criticism off of my blog, quite frankly, because I could do it all day long. I mean, I could spend the next week straight just responding to negative TechCrunch comments about me. I mean, forget about YouTube. That would be like months and months of time. So I really very rarely respond. But if it's factual, then I'll respond, and typically I'll be very polite, and I'll say something along the lines of, if you think of there's an approach called the criticism sandwich, which managers use sometimes, where they'll say, hey Joe, I just wanted to talk for a minute. You know, you're really doing a great job with A, B, and C, and D, but there's this one thing, and then you talk about the criticism, and then it's like, but you know, I really think that you have a lot of potential to do the following great things in the next few months, so just keep it up and just remember that last point I left you with. So you basically have a positive, negative, positive. I try to do that in my comments, so I'll say something like, I understand how you would feel that way. You know, if I had read that other person's post, I would probably respond in the same exact way. Here's one point to keep in mind, though. You know, you said this, in fact, ABC, so you can see how the statement's only accurate if you make this change. Thanks for the comment. You know, I'm always trying to get better, and I appreciate it. Sincerely, Tim. Even if it's a pretty rude comment, I'll do something like that. And there are two things. Even if that person responds back and they're like, "Hey, well, fuck yourself," your readers will have, which happens, it does. Then the respect that your readers have for you will go through the roof when you're very graceful and tactful, number one. Number two, pretty frequently that person will turn around and be like, oh man, I'm sorry, I had a bad day. Like, you know, this guy kicked my dog and my wife spit in my face or whatever. Like, they'll be like, sorry about that. You know, I was just having a really bad day. Like, really appreciate your calm response. I also have an entire post and like a 60-minute presentation on how I deal with haters. So if you search Tim Ferriss, how to deal with haters, then that'll pop right up.
Love it. Okay, we'll also send out a link for that. That's a good one. Let's see here. Next question. This is a more technical question. This is from John Jay. I've been testing glucose and blood pressure, and it's been very frustrating. Last night my glucose was 97 when I went to bed. This morning it was 110. Then I tested it on the other arm 1 minute later and got 101. Yowzers. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Glucometers are very erratic. They can be very erratic. If you're using a one touch, I would abandon it and get what's called a WaveSense Jazz. So the best glucometer that I've found that has the least variability is the WaveSense Jazz. And what I would also say is, even when I was using the WaveSense Jazz, which accounts for environmental factors, I was very typically taking 3 or 4 finger pricks at a time and then averaging numbers, omitting any outliers. So if I had, my general rule was, if they were within 10% of each other, then I would keep them. So if it was, let's say, you know, 86, 88, 84, okay, fine, then it's 86. And I would keep those values. But let's just say I had 86, 88, 84, 97, I would completely omit the 97. So sadly, glucose monitors have a long way to go before they're entirely reliable. But I would say, at the very least, if you bought your glucose monitor at, let's say, a Walgreens or something like that, you probably have a one touch, and they're very, very erratic. So I would use the WaveSense instead.
Okay, great. Next one. This one's from Amber B. I like this question. Can you talk a little bit more about how to use conversational texting in casual situations? Besides using it in my personal life, I'm illiterate. It would be extremely helpful in my job. This is a great one.
This is the one you should answer, Amit, about your. I want to hear about your bar testing.
So let me put it this way. I'll tell you about my bar testing. The first thing people do is they'll say, "What do you do?" Okay. First of all, you can tell these are like, this is kind of a boring question, but you get remarkable results with testing it. So if you say, "I'm a writer," then people go like, "Oh, my friend's a writer too. He's been trying to write this story about how a teddy bear can help reduce global warming, blah, blah, blah." Like, your friend is a loser. He's not a writer. But then, if you tell people you're an author, you get a totally different reaction. Way more interest, way more engagement. And then people say, what do you write about? And that's a whole other opportunity to play with testing. I mean, you could say you write about personal finance. You could say you write about behavioral change. You can even just be crazy and test all kinds of crazy stuff. And people get very, very engaged. The beautiful part about testing like this is when you have, it's like, imagine you're at bat and you can hit like 50 times or 100 times in a night. That's an amazing opportunity for testing. With 50 opportunities in one night, you can walk away with 3 or 4 instances. So if I were a waitress, here's what I would test. I would test eye contact, like less eye contact or more eye contact. I would test being overly smiley and like kind of cute and flirty, and then just like kind of prim and proper. I would also test what you write on the receipt. There's great studies indicating if you put a smiley face or if you draw a picture of a sun, you can increase your tips like 14%. And then you can test, you know, all kinds of other things. How fast, who do you address in the table? You don't have to start with 50 tests. Start with 1 or 2, get a winner, and then take that winner and compete it against the next test. And my guess would be within 2 weeks of rigorous testing, I would be surprised if you couldn't increase your tips by 10%. Right. What do you think, Tim?
I happen to work in restaurants for 4 summers, so I have some thoughts on this. All right, so a few things. I think that restaurants are a fantastic place to develop your social interaction skills. I think they're fantastic because you deal with all sorts of customers. You deal with pains in the ass. You can't be rude to them unless you want to get no tip. So it's a great environment. A few things I would say is the smiley face definitely works, but only if you're a chick generally. or if you live in San Francisco, maybe it'll work as a guy. But a few things I would suggest, things that I noticed. So the first is that if you give people a strong opinion on the food, so if somebody, a few things I tested, when people would always ask, so ask yourself, what are the most common questions that I get? And then have two or three responses that you test on people. So what's the question that waiters and waitresses always get? What do you recommend? Okay, the worst answer to that is, oh, everything's good. Terrible, terrible answer. The best that I found was, my favorite by far is this. My second choice, which is also great, is this. Okay, notice that that is different. That is different from, these are my two favorites. I love both of them. You can try that. I just found, when I came out and I said, this one is amazing, and make sure it's amazing, by the way, but like, this one's amazing, and then this one's also great, it's my second choice. It's extremely effective. The other approach, and you can learn a lot by going to really high-end restaurant and just paying out the nose once to see how they do these things, but if, for example, there's a restaurant in New York City that I went to, and their policy is, and this is the policy at a few very high-end restaurants, if a couple goes out to dinner and they're unsure of whether they want dessert or not, if they're like, ah, oh, we kind of want it, oh, no, we shouldn't, maybe we should, you know what, we're not going to have any dessert, then they bring out a dessert for free for that couple. That's the rule. And so as a server, let's just say it's a $100 meal, okay, so if you get a 20% tip, that's $20. Let's say it would cost you personally out of your pocket $3 to get a free dessert. Give them a free dessert and say, you know what, this one's on me. I really, like, thanks for coming in, guys. And, okay, so that's a good investment of your time, is giving them something free that costs you $3 and then potentially gets you an additional $10. That adds up really quickly. So those would be a few thoughts.
I love that you talked about investing and you're actually putting your own money down as an investment. It's so weird because as a waitress, what waitress ever thinks about investing her own money? But that's exactly what you're doing. And if you invest $3 and you get back $20, you do that all day, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's definitely worth trying, for sure.
Love it. So maybe we could ask everyone listening, what could you invest $10 to $20 a day in? To try to see if you could get something more back. And it doesn't have to be money, by the way. It could be whatever. It could be feeling good. It could be more free time, whatever. Speaking of free time, here's a question from Anonymous. We'll take this one and then one more. What are two specific daily habits that you each employ to ensure that you're maximizing productivity and doing what you love?
Two daily habits. One would be having one particular to-do item that I have identified I would be happy with completing, that would make me satisfied with my entire day, and having one. In other words, if I have 10 items that I could be doing as a to-do list, and we always do, going down it and asking myself, which of these, if completed today, would make me satisfied with my entire day? So for me today, I'll give you an example. That's a column for Men's Journal. Like, finishing a column for Men's Journal would be the one item that I should fix, that I should complete today. That's in my power. The second would be having Charlie get the forum for the 4-Hour Body up and running today. So those are the two. One is on my plate. The other has to be described and delegated to someone else. So that's the first habit. The second habit would be reminding myself that I have more than enough time to do everything that's truly important. Because I think it's easy to get very, very stressed out, and that stress feeds on itself, and then you just end up juggling too many balls or spinning too many plates, and you end up sticking your face in email all day. So just remembering that you actually do have plenty of time to do all the things that are truly important if you do an 80-20 analysis, and just maintaining that calm to the greatest extent possible, realizing that if shit happens, things are going to fall through the cracks, but the big things, if you let the small bad things happen, you can get the big good things done. I think it's just a psychological reminder.
Love that. Okay, let's skip right to the last question here. You both seem very confident in your products and yourselves. Was there a time when you were first starting out when you doubted yourself or your expertise or your products? And if so, how did you find the confidence and courage to put yourself out there and pursue your disproportionate results?
What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I usually don't like these kind of emotional questions because I have no emotions, but I'll try to I'll try to tackle it. I mean, for me, I'll tell you this. It has simply been a series of small tests and small moves. And with, you know, what is that, the Rolling Stone gathers no moss or whatever? Maybe that's right. The wrong analogy. But as you continue doing one thing, you learn so many insights and you can grow to another. So, for example, when I started off with my blog, which, by the way, you can go back and look at both Tim's first blog post and my first blog post and compare that to now. It's way different. And I frankly think that it's not as good. But, of course, we both have gotten better. That didn't happen from – it didn't happen because we used WordPress. It didn't happen because we know SEO. It happened because we were plugging in and writing every day or three times a week, and we just got better by experience and then by also talking to other people we knew who were masters at what they did. So I would say that a lot of times people are looking for tricks and tools and hacks, and they want to know what software we use or something like that. But the more difficult thing is actually to change your mindset, which is to say, can I commit to doing this for 6 months? And if after 6 months I find that I'm not enjoying it or I'm not good at it, I'm going to quit and I'm not going to feel guilty at all. But I'm going to commit for at least 2 months or 6 months, and I'm going to give myself the opportunity to prove that I can get good at this. I think if you can do that, you can often get those disproportionate results because 99% of the people will just give up.
Yep, I agree. I would just add to that that I think that the two areas, if you're trying to improve your confidence overall, the two areas I would focus on are, number one, find some type of sport to train for competition in. I know it sounds very heavy-handed, but I'm serious. Like, go start rock climbing or Brazilian jiu-jitsu or something and aim for a specific deadline, which is a local competition of some type, or a competition within your gym. It doesn't really matter. Powerlifting doesn't make a difference. 10K, whatever. But give yourself something that is trackable and will provide a constant positive, well, not, maybe perhaps not always constant, but positive feedback in terms of progress. And I think that's what people, when in the modern world, sitting in front of a computer, you finish your work, you close your laptop, and nothing has changed, right? You haven't built a table, you haven't built a house, there's no tangible result from that, and I think it causes a lot of psychological malaise. So find some type of sport, some type of physical activity to really take seriously, number one. Number two would be take a class in negotiation, practice public speaking or negotiation, some type of uncomfortable speaking, and get good at that. And I would say that when those two in combination, even if one of them fails, should be very effective for building confidence. Most people lack confidence because they don't have enough practice having uncomfortable conversations, or because they haven't failed much, and sports will cause you to constantly fail, which is why I would prefer something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu over running, because you're just constantly going to be getting arm-barred or whatever. It doesn't have to be dangerous, but you learn to view failure as feedback as opposed to failure as some type of character flaw. And I think that focusing on those two would be very valuable.
Love it. Okay, Tim, I want to thank you for coming. Everybody, 4-Hour Body is his new book, and 4-Hour Workweek, as you know, I've plugged it many, many times as one of the books that changed my life. Tim, man, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a great day, guys. Bye.
Talk to you soon.